This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Broke, the plan to restore our trust, truth, and treasure, by Glenn Beck and Kevin Bell, with contributions from Peter Schweitzer, Tyler Grimm, Colin Balfe, and Gary Brozek. Read by Glenn Beck and Brian Seth.
Dedication. To all the historians who refuse to compromise the truth to be popular, rich, or tenured. History is rife with those who are called crazy by the establishment. They're almost always the ones who change the world, while the establishment is forgotten. Author's note. But what do we mean by the American Revolution? Do we mean the American War? The Revolution was effected before the war commenced. The Revolution was in the minds and the hearts of the people. John Adams, 1818. In the history of the world, America's great experiment with freedom has been nothing more than a blink of the eye. Our way of life, unalienable rights, unquestionable freedoms, unimaginable wealth may seem natural and permanent to us. But among the billions who have lived, we are the only ones to have ever experienced it. And now, I fear, we've never been so close to losing it. I didn't choose to write about this subject because my passion in life is to reform Medicare or cut defense spending. I chose it because it has taken us over 100 years to destroy the great American experiment. And I believe we only have a fraction of that time left to save it. I'm not an expert in this subject, and my detractors will say that I'm only an entertainer or I do this or that just for the money. They couldn't be more wrong. I do shows on Wilson and Coolidge. I talk about Jesus far too much for people. I cry on national television. Am I really a ratings genius? Or is it more likely that I'm just a dad, a husband, a recovering slug, and a concerned American just like you who just wants his children to be able to experience what he did? In the end, I guess you're going to have to decide. As John Adams once said, revolutions take place in the hearts and the minds of the people. To win that battle, we have to usher in a revolution of thought by shifting the debate in America from one about retirement ages and tax hikes to one about individual rights, equality of opportunity, and God's role in our success. They say that the truth shall set you free. But I have found that it will first make you miserable. You know what? I say, bring it on. There is much work to be done, and many tough choices lie ahead. Difficult sacrifices, financial pain, maybe even some dark days. It won't be easy, but nothing worth doing ever is. This audiobook is about understanding that our system of government is broken, because we ourselves are broken in spirit, broken in trust, and broken in our faith. It's about understanding that debts and deficits aren't the disease. No, they're just symptoms of the disease. This audiobook is about learning from the past and seeing that minimum government, maximum freedom isn't just a catchy slogan. It was once a way of life in America. And it is a way of life that we can have back. My hope is this will help you think out of the box politically and motivate you to challenge those who are blocking the doorway to restoration. The time for trusting others in government based on a D or an R has long since passed. Trust yourself. Trust your neighbors. Live your life the right way and prepare to witness miracles. God is not done with freedom. And quite frankly, neither am I. But it all starts with you. you have to find your role, your place in this fight. Remember, the heroes we read about in history books, Paul Revere, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, were usually only a very small part of the story. You don't have to ride the horse at midnight yourself to make a real difference. You just have to help make sure that someone else can. In a few minutes, Brian Sack, who you may know from one of his many appearances on my radio show over the years, is going to take over some of the reading. Now, Brian is a friend, and I did just use air quotes, and I guess you could consider him a writer, air quotes again, though it seems like someone would actually have to buy what you write in order for you to be considered a professional, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, I'll be setting up some of the topics that we cover in Broke, and then Brian will handle the rest. Just remember, I only hired him to read my audiobook, not to ad-lib it or sprinkle in his simple little thoughts. Just read it, word for word. Got it, Brian? Part 1. The Past is Prologue. Quote, "We are perhaps too much inclined to think that external invasion is the only way a civilization can die. If the lights that guide us ever go out, they will fade little by little, as if of their own accord. We therefore should not console ourselves by thinking that the barbarians are still a long way off. Some peoples may let the torch be snatched from their hands, but others will stamp it out themselves." Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. Chapter 1. Ancient History, Modern Lessons. If history teaches us one thing, it is this: empires tend to crumble from the inside. If history teaches us two things, it is that very few people ever see it coming. Perhaps it is because of those two great lessons that George Santayana's famous line continually rings true across civilizations and across the ages: those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Time and time again, once great countries have failed because their citizens thought it would never happen to them. They thought they were immune. They thought they were different. They thought they were better. They were wrong. That is the real danger facing America today. The 2.4 million men and women in our armed forces can and will defeat any foreign enemy we ever face. But it is no longer foreign threats that pose the greatest danger to our future. Indeed, as Tocqueville presciently warned, we are our own greatest danger. We're on the verge of stamping out ourselves. In other words, we have met the enemy, and he is us. The real battle we're fighting right now is with the laws of economics, and it's a war that cannot be won. It's like attempting to fight gravity by constantly jumping. There are slivers in time when it might feel like you're winning, that you've actually changed the laws of nature. Then you crash back to Earth, and eventually you just get too tired to jump anymore. Gravity wins. It always does. Likewise, the laws of economics say that when expenses are higher than revenues for a prolonged period of time, there will be repercussions. Sure, there might be fleeting moments when it looks good, when interest rates stay low and credit ratings stay high. But then, one day people realize their money isn't as secure as they thought. Interest rates jump, credit ratings collapse, panic ensues. The laws of economics win. They always do. Debt, deficits, unemployment rates, inflation rates, interest rates, money supply. These are all important indicators because they measure our progress in the battle, but they are not the disease. They are only the side effects of it. The disease itself, the reason why we're in this economic situation in the first place, is progressivism and all of the free spending, worry about debt later, utopia is within reach policies that all come along with it. And now we've reached a tipping point. For decades, we've been told by leaders and experts that debt should be dealt with in the long term, The deficits really don't matter. The jobs will be plentiful. And that America will always be the world's greatest financial superpower. Look where that's gotten us. Massive, unfathomable debts, trillion-dollar deficits, a budget less balanced than MSNBC. And that's saying something. A job market in which millions can't find work, and a financial system that, by all accounts, was just hours away from the abyss. Maybe it's time to stop listening to the politicians, the professors, the prognosticators, and instead pay attention to the only true predictor of the future, the past.
Picturing the price. We talk a lot about debt in this book, but part of the problem with this topic is that it's become unrelatable to most Americans. Human minds can scarcely begin to comprehend the scope of the problem we're talking about, but let me try one illustration. If you were to take $100 bills, not $1 bills or $20 bills, but $100 bills, and stack them 7 feet tall, and fill in every single inch of an NFL football field from end zone to end zone, that would represent $1 trillion. Now, put 13 of those fields side by side, and you start to picture the size of the debt we've incurred. That is the price of progressive policies. That is the consequence of our nation's live large and put it on charge mentality. That is the result of corruption, lies, and deceit from our self-serving leaders. British scholar C.E.M. Joad, who studied the collapses of the world's great empires, said that the declines all had several things in common: decadence, weariness, and irresponsibility. To that, British historian C. Northcote Parkinson added that collapses are usually marked by an over-centralized government, heavy taxes, and bureaucracy. If any of that sounds familiar, then it's time to stop taking for granted that America is infallible and enduring, and start acting to make it that way. When in Rome. During a 2005 appearance at the National Press Club, David Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States, explained that the United States can be likened to Rome before the fall of the empire. Its financial condition is worse than advertised. It has a broke business model. It faces deficits in its budgets, its balance of payments, its savings, and its leadership. Despite the eye-rolling that normally ensues when anyone tries to mention the fall of the Roman Empire, Walker's warning was not hyperbole. He was dead on. In fact, the parallels between America and the latter stages of the Roman Empire unfortunately go much, much further than most people are comfortable admitting. English politician and historian Edward Gibbon wrote one of the most comprehensive accounts of Rome's collapse ever published, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, released in 6 volumes between 1776 and 1788, explained that human freedom is the first wish of our heart. Freedom is the first blessing of our nature. Yet when people shirk individual responsibility and expect more from government, explained Gibbon, they fall prey to tyranny. And so it was with Rome. They no longer possess that public courage which is nourished by the love of independence, the sense of national honor, the presence of danger, and the habit of command, Gibbon explained. They received laws and governors from the will of their sovereign and trusted for their defense to a mercenary army. Teachable moment. It's interesting to note that our founders were familiar with Gibbon's 1776 work. Thomas Jefferson owned a copy of Decline and Fall and kept it in his library in Monticello. He clearly read it, likely several times, since notes from Jefferson have been found in the margins. Gibbon went on to say that the push for intellectual mediocrity further hastened Rome's collapse. The minds of men were gradually reduced to the same level. The fire of genius was extinguished. Tocqueville had the same observation. When all fortunes are middling, he wrote, passions are naturally restrained, imagination limited, and pleasures simple. Such universal moderation tempers the sovereign's own spirit and keeps within certain limits the disorderly urges of desire. In terms of Rome, Tocqueville was only partially correct. While the state itself was as ruthless and bloodthirsty as ever, it was the people who'd become apathetic. They no longer cared enough about their way of life to defend it. And that's an unsustainable foundation for any society. These are important observations, and while they might seem to have nothing to do with economics, they actually strike right at the heart of the problem. A society that seeks to equalize the minds of men doesn't cherish real learning. Education becomes the right of the few, the elite. In Rome's case, the priests. In our case, the Ivy League. And the masses must accept their interpretation. Likewise, a society that seeks to equalize incentives for work doesn't cherish individualism. In Rome, heavy taxes, some of which were paid not just in money but in food, goods, or livestock, ate away at the incentive to work hard. By the time Emperor Diocletian forced male children to adopt the profession of their father, all motivation, drive, and individual initiative had vanished. Over time, that inevitably results in the tempered spirit that Tocqueville wrote about, which leads to fewer risk-taking entrepreneurs, lower economic growth, fewer jobs, and, generally speaking, a society that is forced to fund itself via debt rather than productivity. As Lactantius wrote in the 4th century, the number of Romans receiving pay was so much larger than the number of those paying taxes, and that because of the enormous size of the assessments. The result, as one historian put it, the multiplication of unproductive services, such as the administrative bureaucracy and heavy military spending, combined to place an intolerable strain on the producers of primary commodities. The explosion of the Roman bureaucracy was fueled by Rome's centralization of power. As the size and strength of government grew, personal ambition withered and a decline of civic vitality quickly ensued. People were accustomed to sending huge chunks of their pay to the government and seeing nothing in return. Those in the cities got an increasing amount of government handouts for their money, a practice that was part of a long-term plan to make people forget about their history. According to Gibbon, it was artfully contrived by Augustus that, in the enjoyment of plenty, the Romans should lose the memory of freedom. With individual liberties squelched and businesses increasingly under government control, the Roman economy could no longer achieve the growth necessary to pay its bills. That left their government with one final desperate move: taxes. Massive, bone-crushing taxes. In fact, Roman taxes became so bad in the later years of the empire that landowners actually fled to barbarian territories, an offense punishable by death, just to avoid paying them. Taxes and regulations grew so unwieldy that they ended up covering virtually every major area of Roman life, from trade to farming to manufacturing to simple labor. Not surprisingly, the taxes largely became unprofitable for the government because merchants spent much of their life trying to avoid paying them. As one Roman writer put it at the time, the whole world groans under the publicani, tax collectors. Teachable moment. This is an interesting parallel to modern-day America. Not only is our bureaucracy growing, but our leaders also seem to be solely interested in the rate of employment instead of the return on employment. In other words, putting people to work in unproductive government jobs may be good for headlines, but it leads to a major strain on private business, since those jobs must eventually be paid for via taxes. It's subsidized employment, and it's a lot different than the true entrepreneurial employment that drives real growth. To placate the Roman people's growing discontent, Emperor Diocletian started offering entertainment and freebies to keep the people calm and docile. They called the ploy bread and circuses. Feed them, distract them, and maybe they won't realize what you've done to them. With eyes averted and personal self-initiative suffocated, the Roman government took on public works projects that encroached into every nook and cranny of private life, regardless of whether it was desired or successful. For example, the frequent and regular distributions of wine and oil, of corn and bread, of money or provisions had almost exempted the poorer citizens of Rome from the necessity of labor. Bribery and corruption soon ran rampant. Class warfare and resentment between citizens quickly followed. As historian Michael Rostovtsev put it, "The peasants hated the landowners and the officials. The city proletariat hated the city bourgeoisie. The army was hated by everybody, even by the peasants." Much has been written about how complicated the downfall of Rome was, but the recipe was actually pretty simple and has since been replicated countless times. A great civilization arises. The state encroaches on freedom and demands more power. People take less responsibility for themselves and want more handouts from the government. Taxes go up to pay for the handouts. The size of government explodes and economic growth slows. The government seeks to divert the public's attention from what is really going on to bread and circuses. Collapse, economic or otherwise, ensues. Greece lightning. The fall of Greece followed a pattern similar to the demise of Rome. Both civilizations displayed a pioneering spirit in their earliest stage of life. Both had thriving arts and architecture, and both served as the cradle for many of the concepts we now associate with Western civilization. It was the Greeks, for example, who developed the ideas of reason and inquiry, which created the groundwork for philosophy and science. They established the foundations of mathematics, including geometry and the rules of numbering. The Greeks were some of the first to establish theaters and develop sculpture as an art form. The citizen class of Greek societies was relatively free, although it still made extensive use of slaves, and the Greeks gave the world its first democracy. But, as so often happens, freedom could not last in the face of crisis. Once economic troubles came, people turned away from the individualism and toward dictators. As one historian recounted, "An economic depression may easily have a dictator in its pocket. Hence, in most of the maritime states of the Greek world, the economic crisis led to a tyrant. A Greek tyrant was, almost always, a noble who, to quote Herodotus, took the people into partnership. He pretended to champion the cause of the poor, got himself assigned a bodyguard, drove out or killed the other nobles, and seized the power." The Greeks suffered from foreign wars, but they also suffered from internal decline. Citizens found it convenient to pick a fight with a neighbor in order to gain slaves, wealth, or property. The Greek historian Thucydides explained that there were the wicked resolutions taken by those who, particularly under the pressure of misfortune, wished to escape from their usual poverty and coveted the property of their neighbors. The Greek historian Polybius noted the same thing. "The people have become accustomed to feed at the expense of others," he wrote, "and their prospects of winning a livelihood depend upon the property of their neighbors." In the end, the virtues of Greek art, law, philosophy, and democracy could not save them from succumbing to that most primitive of the deadly sins, greed. They became their own worst enemy. As we have seen with Arlen Specter and the Republicans, freedom didn't leave the Greeks. The Greeks left freedom. The Spanish Imposition. During the 16th century, Spain was actually the greatest power in Europe. In fact, for more than a century, Spain was more powerful than any other European power since the Romans. Yet, like Rome and Greece, it eventually fell prey to the seduction of the three-headed monster: bloated bureaucracy, centralized power, and skyrocketing taxes. The consequence was massive debt, and by the close of the 18th century, Spain was a shell of its former self. The Spanish Empire's decline began when it began to consume more than it produced. By the time that Philip II became king, he found an empty treasury, stifling taxation and loans from German and Italian bankers, which had mortgaged Spanish income for years ahead. The loans absorbed the royal share of the bullion pouring in from the Indies, and, as soon as past debts might be cleared, there were the obligations Philip had contracted to raise money for his wide operations in behalf of the faith. Before the Spaniards knew it, they were awash in too many state employees, medical practitioners and priests, and not enough businessmen and entrepreneurs. But the most egregious part of all this government largesse, at least to the citizens of Spain, was the so-called Alcabala, which was a 10% excise tax on the transfer of all property, including food. Naturally, to avoid the crushing tax, the Spanish soon became professional smugglers. By one estimate, 90% of Spanish commerce was evading the tax through clever business measures. Tax avoidance became so bad that the Spanish crown sent soldiers to Catalonia to enforce the new taxation, sparking what became a 10-year civil war. To get out of their self-created mess, Spain did what any good tax-and-spend centralized government would. It debased its own currency. Right on cue, the cost of Spanish goods and services ballooned. Spain became a great place to sell stuff to, but a terrible place to buy things from. In discussing Spain's fatal moves toward eventual downfall, one historian summed it up nicely. The most obvious of the causes of the economic decline of a state is usually the extravagance of the government. In other words, frugal government, frugal people. Extravagant government, enslaved people. A flock of timid animals. Harvard professor Neil Ferguson recently described the United States as an empire on the edge of chaos. Could he be right? Or is that just more fear-mongering coming out of Harvard? Of course he could be right. Those 13 football fields filled with endless rows of 7-foot-tall stacks of $100 bills are essentially monetary soldiers, capable of attacking us from the inside at a moment's notice. Anyone who says otherwise is practicing something far more dangerous than fear-mongering, denial. In many ways, we've already made the same fatal mistakes that past empires have. The centralization of power has already begun to dampen entrepreneurialism, foster entitlement, and incentivize the lack of pride in individual accomplishments that tends to precede the downfall of most great empires. Trophies for all participants, anyone? The Romans enjoyed growth through conquest, but once the wars ended, so did the spoils, leaving taxation to make up the difference. Americans enjoy growth through business, but between the vilification of profits and the arduous regulations now being imposed, that too is slowing. Taxation will again be forced to make up the difference. Perhaps the most eye-opening warning about America's precarious position is from Tocqueville himself in 1840. Having thus taken each citizen in turn in its powerful grasp and shaped him to its will, government then extends its embrace to include the whole of society. It covers the whole of social life with a network of petty, complicated rules that are both minute and uniform, through which even men of the greatest originality and the most vigorous temperament cannot force their heads above the crowd. It does not break men's will, but softens, bends, and guides it. It seldom enjoins, but often inhibits, action. It does not destroy anything, but prevents much from being born. It is not at all tyrannical, but it hinders, restrains, enervates, stifles, and stultifies so much that in the end, each nation is no more than a flock of timid and hard-working animals with the government as its shepherd. Arnold Toynbee, a British historian who wrote the 12-volume classic Study of History, says that societies face a pattern of challenge and response. A challenge, whether from natural disaster, foreign invasion, or internal erosion, is inevitable and natural, he says. The question is how a nation responds. It is now our chance to provide an answer. We must not be a flock of timid animals. We must be our own shepherd. Studying the suicidal moves of three once-epic empires, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and 16th-century Spain, reveals that our nation is responding in an all-too-familiar way that will have an all-too-familiar ending. Present-day Greece can teach us a lot, too. The only way out is if, citizen by citizen, the public learns the lessons of history and convinces others that we are not immune to the laws of economics. We can still choose individual achievement, limited government, and low taxes, but we have to turn the corner now. God's hand has been evident throughout America's history, and now there is one more gift to add to the list. Unlike past empires, we've been given the ability to see into the past. Through technology, education, and history books, we've been handed a roadmap that can fend off human nature and lead us toward enduring freedom. Now we just have to follow it. Rather go to bed supperless than rise in debt. Benjamin Franklin, Poor Richard's Almanac. Chapter 2. Frugal, a four-letter word. One of my all-time favorite Christmas stories is Charles Dickens' classic, A Christmas Carol. The story's memorable mean-spirited miser, Ebenezer Scrooge, has become synonymous with tightwad. But the truth is that Scrooge was not thrifty, he was greedy. There is a huge difference between those terms, and it's one that, over time, many people have been conditioned to forget. Today, those who prize frugality are considered old-fashioned, crusty enemies of progress. Saving, the story goes, is hoarding, and hoarders prevent the economy from growing. If you save money, not only are you boring, you're also contributing to the downfall of America. But if you're one of those evil savers, cheer up. Frugality may go in and out of style, but it's always been a virtue. While America may currently be experiencing a shift toward the spending side, the pendulum always swings back in the other direction. Consider a few examples of how frugality has been viewed over time. I have three precious things which I hold fast and prize. The first is gentleness, the second is frugality, the third is humility, which keeps me from putting myself before others. Be gentle and you can be bold. Be frugal and you can be liberal. Avoid putting yourself before others and you can become a leader among men. Lao Tzu, 600-531 BC. Thrift comes too late when you find it at the bottom of your purse. Seneca. Make all you can, save all you can, give all you can. John Wesley, founder of Methodism. He who does not economize will have to agonize. Confucius. If you would be wealthy, think of saving as well as getting. Benjamin Franklin. A wise and frugal government which shall leave men free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government. Thomas Jefferson. Economical in the use or appropriation of money, goods or provisions of any kind, saving unnecessary expense, either of money or anything else which is to be used or consumed, sparing, not profuse, prodigal, or lavish. Webster's Definition of Thrift, 1828. Flash forward to today. When most people hear thrift, they think about thrift stores or thrift clothes, terms that are associated with concepts like cheap and low quality. America's founders saw it differently. They prized thrift, not just because they saw firsthand what extravagance can lead to, but because they understood that frugality wasn't just about saving money. It was also about saving freedom. If you think of debt as a tie that binds you to others, then it's not a stretch to believe that personal savings yields personal liberty. Thrift as a moral virtue and as a utilitarian practice, wrote Professor William Nunn, was a cornerstone in the development of capitalism as an economic system and individualism as its philosophy. The father of capitalism, Adam Smith, certainly believed this. In his book, The Wealth of Nations, Smith argued that robust saving is a basic tenet of economic progress. And it makes sense. You can't have capitalism without, well, capital. swapping government for God. The recent denigration of profits and wealth is right out of the progressive playbook. They make wealth synonymous with greed and profits synonymous with corruption. After a while, people start to think to themselves, maybe I don't want to be rich after all. Wealth isn't something to be admired, it's something to be avoided. So people borrow, they spend, they live the high life, and sure enough, they are never wealthy. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The reason this is so important is that fewer wealthy citizens means fewer jobs. Fewer jobs means fewer people to take care of others, which in turn allows the government to make a case that it has to step in to fill the void. After all, if individuals were still willing and able to engage in private, willful charity and philanthropy, as used to be the tradition, we wouldn't need government to do it. Ben Franklin, a frugal yet strong advocate for charity, once wrote, "Do not depend too much upon your own industry, and frugality, and prudence, though excellent things, for they may all be blasted without the blessing of heaven, and, therefore, ask that blessing humbly, and be not uncharitable to those that at present seem to want it, but comfort and help them. Remember, Job suffered, and was afterwards prosperous." It seems that many people have forgotten one of the basic principles of a republic, virtue. A large percentage of the population must be virtuous in order for society to properly function. But virtue requires morality, and morality requires adherence to a religion that embraces charity as a pillar of its theology and recognizes a higher power than the government. The United States was founded on Judeo-Christian principles, which embraced personal giving and charity as fundamental. And that was the way most Americans lived. Charity through voluntary giving in service of God. Then FDR and progressives came along and changed all of that. Charity still meant fulfilling your financial obligation to a higher power, but that higher power went from being God to being the United States government. The government's incessant march toward removing all traces of religion and faith, along with its reluctance to help faith-based charity groups, is no accident. It's because that leaves the government itself as the charity of last resort. Strip out religion and strip away morality, virtue, and eventually personal charity. All that you have left is Washington, D.C. When was the last time a poor person created jobs? Noted titans of American industry like Andrew Carnegie advocated wealth creation as a key driver of private charity. Carnegie amassed his fortune with a simple principle: watch the costs and the profits will take care of themselves. Carnegie valued living below one's means. However, that was not because he wanted to be the richest man on earth. It was because he wanted to help others. The man who dies thus rich dies disgraced, he once said. Andrew Carnegie put his money where his mouth was. Before his death in 1919, Carnegie gave away $350 million, 90% of his fortune, more than any American before him had ever even possessed. Obama would have loved him because he really spread it around. He gave millions to Christian groups feeding the poor, millions more to libraries. His donations funded an astonishing 1,700 libraries across the country, and millions to schools like the University of Chicago. Black and Christian schools also received large donations. Teachable moment. In 1872, when Carnegie entered steel production, the price of steel was $56 per ton. He invented a new production technique that brought costs down and quality up. By 1900, Carnegie Steel was producing steel for $11.50 per ton and had become the world's largest industrial corporation. My good friend and mentor John Huntsman Sr. is living his life the same way. He's a multi-billionaire who intends to give away the vast majority of his wealth before he dies. The impact he is already having through his Huntsman Cancer Foundation, among other things, is astounding and, in my estimation, is far greater than any government entity could ever hope for. He is really the perfect example of why we should be encouraging private wealth instead of demonizing it. Contrary to what progressives would have you believe, the American tradition of thrift was never synonymous with hoarding or being cheap or greedy. It wasn't accumulation for accumulation's sake. On the contrary, thriftiness frees the individual to be generous in giving to God. It is the secret ingredient to charity. Richard Baxter, a Puritan thinker, put it this way: "Frugality or sparing is an act of fidelity, obedience, and gratitude, by which we use all our estates so faithfully for the chief owner, so obediently to our chief ruler, and so gratefully to our chief benefactor, as that we waste it not in any other way." Doing well and doing good are not, as Carnegie, Franklin, Huntsman, and so many other wealthy Americans understood, mutually exclusive. Whether or not one subscribes to trickle-down economics, there's absolutely no doubt that trickle-down charity is the most effective kind. But that reality didn't fit into the progressive agenda. If wealth and private charity worked, then government would remain limited. So the spin and propaganda began. Government programs turned frugality into a synonym for greed. Those who build wealth, the story went, should feel guilty because there are so many with so little. The results were predictable: more power for the government, more money flowing through their coffers, and plenty of people still struggling. Teachable moment. The disease of secularism, along with Woodrow Wilson and FDR's embrace of the so-called social gospel as a justification for massive federal spending sprees, has fundamentally altered American attitudes toward thrift and savings. As William L. Nunn wrote in 1938, "The concept of thrift, as originally grounded in Puritan doctrines and in a simple agrarian economy, is undergoing a drastic change in the United States today. Long-time or secular economic and social trends, accentuated by the recent activities of the government agencies and by widespread consumer purchasing on a pay-as-you-use basis, are responsible." Nunn went on to argue that with the government offering a form of social insurance, the practice of individual thrift was no longer a necessity. Frugality fosters freedom. The founders understood and embraced the freedom that comes with self-restraint in spending. As historian David Steigerwald notes, Ben Franklin didn't seek wealth because he wanted the trappings of money. His primary objective was to achieve freedom to do as he wished. Seeing money as a means to achieve freedom radically alters one's beliefs about appropriate levels of government spending. Over time, progressives have successfully persuaded many Americans that government spending is an indicator of our national compassion. But when considered from the classical view of American thrift, the opposite is true. Government spending is really a measure of erosion and encroachment on personal freedom. The more you send to Washington, the less you have available to do with what you want, which ostensibly would include helping others in a real, tangible way. In his book, Thrift and Generosity, The Joy of Giving, Dr. John Templeton Jr., president of the Templeton Foundation, offers a great picture of thrift properly understood. Thrift is not so much a matter of how much we have, but of how we appreciate, value, and use what we have. Everyone, regardless of income level, has opportunities to exercise the virtue of thrift. We practice thrift by monitoring how we spend our time and money, and then by making better decisions. Templeton's words are timely, considering that Americans have managed their personal budgets about as well as our politicians have managed the federal one. Consider this. In the early 1980s, the American savings rate was between 10 and 12%. After 2005, the savings rate dropped below zero, although, to be fair, the increased purchasing of gold makes these numbers somewhat hard to compare. It has recently rebounded slightly, likely because people have again begun to see the merits of having financial freedom. One of the main instigators of fiscal propaganda was John Maynard Keynes, whose views we'll look at in later chapters. His influential book, General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, argued what he called the paradox of thrift. Thrift was not virtue, Cain said, because it undermined prosperity. Now, seriously, this was a real argument. Popular economic textbooks soon began picking up this storyline and turning it into economic gospel. As one subsequently put it, thrift, which has always been held in high esteem by our economy, now becomes something of a social vice. As Columbia history professor Richard Hofstadter wrote, "This view marked a shift from a working and saving ethic to an ethic which stresses the value of leisure and the pleasure of consumption." Similarly, in 1963, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson noted that progressives had successfully turned things upside down without the public even realizing it. In kindergarten, we were all taught that thrift is always a good thing. Benjamin Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac never tired of preaching the doctrine of saving. And now, along comes a new generation of alleged financial experts who seem to be telling us that black is white and white is black, and that the old virtues may be modern sins. It's a perfect summation of progressivism. 2 + 2 = 5. Sure, your calculator may say 4, but that's only because it doesn't know that times have changed. It was built on old rules, outmoded technology, antiquated theories. In short, your eyes and brain are no longer trustworthy. Only the self-proclaimed experts are. Not everyone, however, was fooled by Keynes's economic sleight of hand. Senator Everett Dirksen, once the head of a savings and loan in Pekin, Illinois, was upset that Keynes considered thrift a vice rather than a virtue. Dirksen prayed for help in restoring saving to its proper place in the minds of Americans. "Let God give me strength, that I may help to get America back on the beam and elevate thrift to the pedestal it rightly deserves, because thrift and opportunity have been the great horsemen of progress in America." Back to the future. Once this new view on saving and thrift became prevalent, it attached itself like an economic cancer to our way of life. And that's where America is today, with a disease that needs to be eradicated from our system. In the 1950s, consumer debt rose by nearly 200%. By 1960, two-thirds of American households were in some sort of debt. Why? Because consumption had become king. The result was a growth boom in the 1960s, forever hooking politicians on the idea that spending could actually drive America's economy forward. We now know how that has turned out. Consumer spending makes up roughly 71% of the American economy. If we don't spend, we die. That leaves politicians with only one option: to continue to spin spending as a positive. They have to. There's no other choice. Remember what President Bush said after 9/11. "Go shopping. It's our patriotic duty." The way forward couldn't be more clear, yet it also couldn't be more difficult. More savings, less spending. More private charity, fewer public handouts. Those are values this country was built on, and while it may seem counterintuitive, they're values that will bring us back to real, sustainable growth. Frugality ignites freedom. America must rediscover that. Following this path means rejecting Keynes, rejecting spending as charity, rejecting spending as a means to end recessions, rejecting new credit card deals, teaser interest rates, or easy payment plans. But most of all, it means rejecting the material things we've been conditioned to believe matter the most. Things like new televisions, cars, boats, and homes. That doesn't mean we all have to live like it's 1776, but it does mean that we have to understand how those who founded our country viewed economics. After all, those views took our tree of liberty from sapling to superpower in record time. They are worth remembering. So let's go back to the beginning, to a time when Washington was a man, not a city, when John Maynard Keynes was still 100 years away from sucking his thumb, and when debt was considered as toxic as the drinking water. Welcome to America in the 1700s. I sincerely believe that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale. Thomas Jefferson to John Taylor, 1816. Chapter 3. The Founders. A Revolutionary Way to Think About Debt. No one said forming a new country would be easy. Just ask John Jay. Jay was the president of the Continental Congress and later went on to become the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Back then, we were a raucous nation and riots were a regular occurrence. So regular, in fact, that they were often sparked by the strangest of things. For example, as Jay found out, severed cadaver arms. In 1788, a medical student was sitting in his New York City classroom working on a cadaver arm when another young man peeped into the classroom to see what was going on. Severed arm in hand, the medical student waved the bloody limb at the classroom visitor and jokingly declared that the arm belonged to the Peeping Tom's mother. The problem? The Peeping Tom's mother had just died. The grieving young man dashed home and told his father what he'd just seen. Soon thereafter, a mob of angry rioters assembled outside the classroom. Meanwhile, John Jay was walking around Manhattan, minding his own business and doing typical founding father stuff, when he encountered the rioting throng. Rioters' bricks began whizzing through the air, and Jay's head quickly morphed into a bullseye. A brick left two large holes in his forehead, according to accounts at the time, and he got his skull almost cracked. Many say that God's hand can be found everywhere in America's founding, and this incident was no exception. Despite his injuries, Jay suffered no brain damage, which is a good thing if you like fiscal responsibility. While Jay may be a lesser-known founding father, he was fixated, you might even say obsessed, on preventing our fledgling little country from becoming a debt-riddled nation destined for oppression and tyranny. As Jay saw it, nothing stood to upend the American experiment faster than a nation that bought things it couldn't afford. Let it never be said that America had no sooner become independent than she became insolvent, or that her infant glories and growing fame were obscured and tarnished by broken contracts and violated faith, in the very hour when all the nations of the earth were admiring and almost adoring the splendor of her rising. Today's big spenders in Washington would have loathed John Jay's fiscal discipline, but they would have really had it out for an even bigger tightwad, Thomas Jefferson. Like John Brickhead Jay, Tom Tightwad Jefferson believed that the threat of debt hovered over the nation's neck like a financial guillotine. He felt so strongly about the issue that he dubbed public debt the greatest of dangers to be feared. He realized that debt is a weapon to be wielded by those to whom it is owed. And this, he understood, is especially dangerous when it is owed to foreign governments or entities. To preserve our independence, Jefferson said, we must not let our rulers load us with public debt. Notice the key phrase he used, not let our rulers. He didn't say our rulers must not. He said that it's up to the people to not let them. It's a subtle difference, but an important one, as it underscores the fact that the voting public has stood by while administration after administration has buried us with debt. The road to serfdom. There's another consequence of debt that doesn't get talked about much these days, but that Jefferson understood well. Debt forces people to work longer hours to pay it off through taxation. That means less time with one's family, less time to enjoy one's personal freedoms, less time to powder one's wig. You know, the fun stuff. Here are Jefferson's own words. We must make our choice between economy and liberty, or confusion and servitude. If we run into such debts, we must be taxed in our meat and drink, in our necessities and comforts, in our labor and in our amusements. If we can prevent the government from wasting the labor of the people under the pretense of caring for them, they will be happy. What's fascinating is that even though Thomas Jefferson himself died cashless under loads of personal debt, he still understood that taking other people's money and blowing it on frivolous junk was immoral. It broke the public trust. It poisoned the tree of liberty. And he knew from his own personal spending habits that trusting politicians with other people's money through taxes was foolish. Jefferson's view was extremely libertarian. Look, if I want to build a swank mansion with a sweet dome at Monticello with my own dough and roll my own financial dice, so be it. But I'll be damned if I'm going to swipe your wallet to fund my pet political projects. That's theft. That's wrong. Ah, financial stewardship. What a novel and bizarre concept. James Madison, author of the Constitution, also understood the serious long-term problems debt could pose for the new nation. He expressed two major concerns. First, that Americans would not stand for taxes being collected simply to pay for interest on debt instead of actual government services. And second, that interest payments on debt would show the world we were a creditworthy nation. Why did that worry him? Because Madison worried that once foreign powers knew our payments could be counted on, they'd gobble up our debt and thereby, pretty generally, buy out the Americans. If Madison could only see us now. There's no such thing as a coincidence. One of the common denominators among our founders was that most of them had been inspired by the genius Scottish moral philosopher and economist Adam Smith. It almost seems providential that Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations at the time of America's birth, because our founding fathers not only read it, they were deeply influenced by it. Jefferson recommended The Wealth of Nations as the best book on economics. Hamilton paraphrased passages from it in his reports on banking, currency, and manufacturers. While The Wealth of Nations was Smith's best-known book, he'd actually written some prescient passages nearly two decades earlier. "Little else is required," he wrote, "to carry a state to the highest degree of affluence from the lowest barbarism but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, all the rest being brought about by the natural course of things. All governments which thwart the natural course are unnatural and, to support themselves, are obliged to be oppressive and tyrannical." Put simply, Smith understood the critical ingredient of all economic activity, human nature. He also understood that governments, by their very nature, disrupt free will and free markets because they run on power. ADD moment. Adam Smith was such a deep thinker that he once fell into a tannery pit while trying to explain division of labor to a friend. The founders, too, had a keen understanding of human nature. They were well steeped in the Judeo-Christian beliefs of human fallibility. As they saw it, Adam and Eve's fall were evidence of human selfishness, and the Pharaoh was evidence of tyranny. They knew that humans are sinful, even depraved creatures who, when armed with the national purse, could do catastrophic economic damage. Starry-eyed utopian idealists they were not. They understood that there was no guarantee self-government would work. In fact, in some quarters, they were downright daunted and pessimistic. The weight of self-government, the Federalist declared, was a burden to which Greek and Roman shoulders proved unequal. America was still very much an experiment in progress, and debt, the founders knew, was a surefire way to end it. The War on Debt. There's a very good reason why our founders were so anxious about public debt. America was mired in it at the time of its founding. The cause? The Revolution. The War for Independence wasn't just fought with muskets and cannons, it was a financial fight too. War is expensive. Soldiers need salaries, cannons cost cash, but America had almost no money. Things got so bad financially that American commanders often complained that their troops were almost naked and had no weapons. To finance the war, we'd taken out loans from both foreign powers and ordinary citizens, who chipped in by buying bonds, a pretty risky endeavor given that we didn't really even have a government to back them. These days, it has almost become cliché to say that our fiscal problems could be used against us by our enemies. But back in the Revolutionary period, it wasn't a cliché at all. It was an actual strategy. Here's how the Pennsylvania Packet described America's financial situation in March 1780. Britain, foiled in her attempts to conquer America by force, is now carrying on a war of finance. The field of battle is changed for the field of the budget, and the longest purse aided by the best schemes for raising or creating a revenue will in a great measure determine the point. The last resource, then, is finance. Even back then, our enemy understood that having a strong economy is just as critical to national security as having a strong military. That put our founders in a really difficult spot. Here were a bunch of ragtag individualists with a blazing dream of self-governance and liberty, and the only chance they had to gain independence was by being completely dependent on others for financial support. Nevertheless, the founders put their egos aside and hit up investors in both the United States and Europe. Ben Franklin scored a $5.9 million loan from France. Then, with the help of John Adams, he scraped together another $2 million from the Dutch. Back in the United States, the war had to be financed by individuals, and the wealthy alone wouldn't cut it. As Robert Wright wrote in his book, One Nation Under Debt, the number and diversity of holders of U.S. government bonds was impressive in the United States itself, and included a variety of professionals, merchants, master artisans, former soldiers, farmers, planters, foreign potentates, and investors. The amounts varied. In South Carolina, for example, bonds ranged from $1.04 to $804,000. These bonds, as you might imagine given the circumstances, had been hastily written. During the War for Independence, Robert Morris, the financier of the Revolution, and his staff had dashed off handwritten notes to people in exchange for livestock, cloth, and other goods necessary to equip the army. We're not talking about a well-oiled fundraising machine here. America was desperate. The nation was literally fighting for its existence. The Brits, of course, realized that they had America by the throat financially, and so they began to apply pressure. They did everything in their power to trash the fundraising efforts by launching a monetary jihad against American efforts. They counterfeited bonds to make investors nervous, and they blasted the colonist bonds as worthless to sway public perception. The only good use for the bonds, the Brits said, was for wallpaper. Fortunately, the public realized it was propaganda. People of all kinds turned into investors and snatched up the bonds. In 1795, about 21,500 different entities owned U.S. national bonds. Even founding fathers like George Washington, George Clinton of New York, and Caesar Rodney of Delaware owned slices of the revolutionary bond pie. There's nothing like a little personal financial stake to get people motivated. After the war was won, a debate quickly ensued about how to manage future expenses. Should all expenditures, no matter how pertinent society thought they were, be fully paid for when promised? Or was debt okay in certain situations? These were big questions, but a consensus emerged among the founders over time. The general view was that carefully managed debt could be helpful in two narrow realms, trade or commerce, and in fighting and winning wars. After all, in war, the Federalists wrote, the longest purse prevails. Beyond that, debt was to be fiercely avoided. It was a pretty unambiguous stance, which is why the issue of national debt played only a minor role at the constitutional conventions and no role during the ratification debates. There just wasn't much left to discuss. Except for commerce and wars, debt was off limits. One of the main criticisms of the king and the British system among the founders was extravagance and indulgence among the government. Harvard College President Samuel Langdon preached a sermon to the Massachusetts legislature in May 1775, declaring, "The general prevalence of vice has changed the whole face of things in the British government." He asked, "In what does the British nation now glory?" His answer, "In titles of dignity without virtue, in vast public treasures continually lavished in corruption till every fund is exhausted, notwithstanding the mighty streams perpetually flowing in." He went on to call for eliminating vast unnecessary expenses continually incurred by its enormous vices. Can you imagine the president of Harvard talking like that today? Swindling futurity. Chief among the Just Say No to National Debt faction was Thomas Jefferson. For Jefferson, trading future financial prosperity for short-term gain was essentially theft. The principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale, he said. In fact, Jefferson was such a deficit hawk that he wanted a balanced budget amendment for the Constitution that would take, from the federal government, the power of borrowing. Some apologists for big federal spending seek historical cover by suggesting that Alexander Hamilton seemed to laud debt. As evidence, they offer up Hamilton's quote that a national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It sounds like damning evidence, other than the if it's not excessive qualifier, except for the fact that the quote is now being used completely out of context. Far from praising national spending sprees, Hamilton was actually referring to debt being an opportunity for America to bolster her standing on the international stage by making good on her financial promises. As Hamilton wrote in his 1790 Report on Public Credit, states, like individuals, who observe their engagements are respected and trusted, while the reverse is the fate of those who pursue an opposite conduct. Hamilton knew that the biggest challenge for early America was liquid capital. The trouble was, we didn't have any. It's like the chicken and egg quandary that many young people find themselves in today. A good credit score is required to borrow money, but you can't get a good credit score without having money. So, from time to time, Hamilton believed we had to dip into the debt column to build that trust on the international stage. But there's another Hamilton quote that you won't hear many spending lovers repeat. The creation of debt should always be accompanied with the means of extinguishment. In other words, when Washington whips out the national credit card in a time of crisis, such as a war, it needs to have a plan for how it's going to pay that money back. ADD moment! No wonder progressivism got so popular. We could never have survived with such a crazy, antiquated view of debt like that. It is in that context that Hamilton's frequently misconstrued quotation has to be considered. That is, if we can make good on our financial promises, a national debt, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. It will be a powerful cement to our union. If gone unpaid, however, that cement would weigh America down with a reputation as a deadbeat borrower. Hamilton's view was pretty clear, but in The Continentalist, he elaborated further by saying that government funding should be done with a combination of permanent funds and grants renewed each year. Permanent funds are indispensable, he said, but they ought to be of such a nature and so moderate in their amount as never to be inconvenient. Hamilton was, in fact, so worried about a perpetual and growing debt that he came up with an idea to make sure it could never happen, a sinking fund. This fund, which would be separate from the general fund and would be financed by post office revenues. These revenues would be completely off limits to politicians and instead would be used to retire 5% of the debt every year until it was paid off. John Brickhead Jay shared the same concerns as Hamilton. Jay had arguably contributed the five most important essays of the Federalist Papers and was a diplomat who believed that paying off our debt was important for America's good standing in the world. Fortunately, most of the other founders agreed. Debt repayment became such a no-brainer that an 1801 Committee on Ways and Means report concluded that the propriety of pursuing measures for the final extinguishment of the public debt is a position too obviously true to require any illustration. Too obviously true. This strategy turned out to be exactly what our fledgling country needed, and foreign countries began taking note of our financial responsibility. In fact, by 1794, founders' disciplined paying down of the national debt meant America enjoyed the highest credit rating in Europe. Talleyrand, who would later go on to be the French foreign minister, said that the American bonds were safe and free from reverses. They have been funded in such a sound manner, and the prosperity of this country is growing so rapidly that there can be no doubt of their solvency. This view would serve America well in the decades to come. Maybe a little too well. teachable moment. That quote from Talleyrand brings up a really good point that not a lot of people like to talk about. The days of America growing so rapidly as to be able to pay off all debts are likely behind us. That doesn't mean our best days are behind us. Gross domestic product and happiness are not mutually exclusive concepts. Consider the numbers. The average growth rate of our economy from after the Great Depression, 1939, through the end of Reagan's Morning in America, 1988, was 4.3% a year. Looking at it by decade, the United States had similar growth rates in the 1970s, 3.3%, 1980s, 3.1%, and 1990s, 3.2%. The 2000s, however, were not so kind. Growth averaged just 1.9% a year. Economists think we'll bounce back with 3.1% growth in 2010 and 3% growth in 2011. But even if that happens, and it's a very big if, that's still nowhere near the kind of growth we had over most of the 20th century, let alone during a time like the Industrial Revolution. The Congressional Budget Office has growth pegged at 2.2% a year going forward, a much lower forecast that would pose huge problems for the economy over the long term. Consider the math. If our economy were to grow at 3.5% for the next 70 years, GDP would be $162.2 trillion. If we instead grew at 2.2%, GDP would be just $66.9 trillion. Small changes, big consequences. Borrowing for bailouts? Today, we just assume that debt will be used as a way to manage the economy's fluctuations. But the founders would have laughed in the face of anyone offering that opinion back then. In his farewell address, Washington described public credit as a very important source of strength and security. He recommended that we use it sparingly as possible, avoiding occasions of expense by cultivating peace. Furthermore, Washington argued that we avoid the accumulation of debt by vigorous exertions in time of peace to discharge the debts which unavoidable wars have occasioned, not ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burden which we ourselves ought to bear. In 1792, a panic ignited by land speculators erupted in the financial markets. The crash has been tremendous, Jefferson reported, and bankruptcies continue to increase. In response, Hamilton launched a debt-funded stimulus plan, which included a compassionate bailout for those who bought land next to garbage dumps and the nationalization of a huge chunk of General Buggy Works. Or maybe not. No, instead of using bailouts, Hamilton used a far more powerful policy, common sense. He ensured that folks with solid credit got loans. He used government funds to pay off bonds in the open market. And he eased up on the collection of debts owed to the government to keep liquidity in the system. Wonder of all wonders, it worked. Our founders' commitment to cinching America's financial belt and boosting the nation's credit abroad also allowed the United States to grow, literally. By the early 1800s, France was cash-strapped and needed money to fuel its own war with Britain. Having just taken possession of a chunk of land in North America from Spain, France had the perfect bargaining chip to use in funding its war effort. Napoleon, the first emperor of France, had dreams of colonizing the New World and building an empire, but he knew that given the war with Britain, the territory would be too hard to defend. Having been previously impressed with America's conscientiousness in repaying its debts, Napoleon was ready to make a deal. And what a deal it was! For just 4 pennies an acre, France sold us 828,800 square miles of land, an area larger than the countries of France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Holland, Switzerland, and the British Isles combined. It was a little real estate transaction that you probably now know by its more popular name, the Louisiana Purchase. There was one small catch before the deal of the century could be consummated, however. Napoleon wanted cash up front, and America had only about a quarter of the money on hand. To make up the difference, Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin floated bonds, which sold very well, likely due to our stellar credit history. On May 2, 1803, the treaty was signed, adding one more approved use of debt to the founders' list, expansion. Checks and balances for our checking account balances. While the founders obviously got a lot right, they did get one thing wrong. They thought the biggest obstacle to keeping spending under control would come from the president, not the Congress. That fit with their Judeo-Christian beliefs that gave them a crystal-clear understanding of human nature. Politicians, like most individuals, were sinful, self-interested creatures who were not to be trusted spending other people's money. The founders had also been shaped by their experience with Great Britain's big spending king. They did everything in their power to set up the American system in a way that would prevent any American president, our version of a king, from being able to ruin the country with debt. Their solution was to balance the president's power with that of hundreds of representatives from around the country. Hundreds of politicians, all to keep one person in check. What they didn't count on, of course, was that the president and the Congress would one day simultaneously become reckless with our money. Overall, of course, the founders did an amazing job in setting the course for the country. During George Washington's 2 terms in office,